The Tom Woods Show, episode 2198.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to have Jeremy Hammond back on the show. Jeremy, you've been on this show to talk about rather a diversity of topics, let's say, because you were on one of my rare debate episodes, and I sure would like to have more of those. But you were on to talk about Israel-Palestine, that issue. But you've also been on to talk about COVID, the vaccine question, so health-related things. So like most libertarians, you're interested in everything. That's kind of the way I've been able to keep the Tom Woods Show going, is that I'm interested in everything. But in terms of your background, what would you say are the most salient features for somebody new to you to know about?
Well, I started out really focused on foreign policy and U.S. foreign policy in the wake of 9/11 and the quote-unquote war on terrorism. And that really evolved into an intense focus on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Eventually started researching economics more. One of the other episodes that you and I did, Tom, was on my book, Ron Paul versus Paul Krugman. And then really in 2012, my son was born. And around that time, I just started applying my journalism skills and my research skills to going into the medical literature for myself to be able to make informed choices about vaccinations for our son. And that was really, that really began once I had acquired that knowledge. I was compelled to start writing about that topic as well due to the disparity between what government and the mainstream media say science says and what the science actually tells us. And of course, with the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown responses, for which the end game from the beginning was always coerced mass vaccination, this has really just become the sole focus of my work.
Remember that episode involving the students at Covington Catholic High School, where Nicholas Sandman was accused of insensitivity because he smirked at some guy pounding a drum in his face? That was a case where, unlike medicine or any of these huge fields, you could become the world's foremost expert on that after just watching 2 hours worth of video. That's all you had to do. And so when I watched those 2 hours worth of video and I found that it completely contradicted what was being said in the media, I felt the way you feel about these bigger issues. I felt absolutely compelled to tell the world about this because I knew I had absolutely no fear of contradiction whatsoever because I've seen literally every stitch of evidence there is. I've seen the whole thing. And now I have to go out there and smash all the bad guys. Likewise with, as you mentioned, the COVID thing. Well, from the very beginning, because I'm a normal human being, I had tried to look around to see if there were any dissident voices talking about this, because everybody was talking about doom and gloom. And if it is going to be doom and gloom, I also want to know about that. But if there was anybody who had any more benign way of looking at this, or not benign, but at least saying, well, maybe it's not going to be as bad as they say. I just wanted to hear it. I wanted to know what the range of opinions were. And that's what eventually took me down the line of, the things they're recommending we do don't seem to be doing any good. I thought, oh, really? Oh, now that's interesting. And then the more I looked at these charts, the more I thought, look, I don't care what degrees you have. I don't care what letters are after your name. You can't explain this chart on the basis of your assumptions, period. I don't have to go to medical school to know that. I know what your assumptions are because you told me. And these charts are depicting a reality that is completely at odds with what you're saying. So again, I feel like, well, I have at least some kind of microphone here. I've got to get out there and do what I can as one person. So we're very, very similar on this. So I want you now to tell us the story about what happened with you on LinkedIn. I've never been on LinkedIn. I mean, maybe there was some benefit to it, but I didn't immediately see it. And I just work on my own and I'm not really sure it does me any good. And now that I find out how restrictive it is, maybe it's just as well. But what trouble were you causing over on LinkedIn that led to this result?
Well, Tom, the mainstream media so-called fact-checking industry, one of the key points that I'd like to make here for your listeners is that the government and mainstream media fact-checkers actually have no problem with misinformation as long as it aligns with the adopted political agenda. My experience with LinkedIn reinforces that point. I was repeatedly had posts deleted by LinkedIn or blocked by LinkedIn for reporting factually accurate information that contradicted disinformation from the public health establishment. I was eventually actually suspended. My account was suspended. In doing that, LinkedIn cited three of my posts. One is kind of an outlier. I just had reshared an article that I had written many, many years ago, talking about how the mainstream media was still propagating this propaganda claim that the 2009 presidential election in Iran was stolen by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And I was just resharing that article. I don't know why LinkedIn flagged that one as misinformation. I just suspect that because it talked about election and stolen, that their algorithm assumed that I was talking about Trump, the election being stolen from Trump. I don't know.
It's incredible how crude these algorithms can be.
Right, right. So that was kind of the outlier. But the other two, I know exactly why I was blocked. The second one was an article I had written correcting mainstream media misinformation about a study on ivermectin. So all the headlines at the time were reporting that the study showed that ivermectin doesn't work. So I read the study. This, again, drives home the importance of actually checking sources. And when they cite sources and they claim that sources say this, you got to go to the primary source materials and verify it for yourself, because they're just lying about what the study said. So the study actually showed the real key finding was that the ivermectin treated group had a 69% lower odds of death. But the thing was, is that that finding was not statistically significant of the overlapping confidence intervals. So an accurate interpretation of the study is that it suggests that ivermectin might be an effective treatment, but the study may have been underpowered and you'd probably have to redo the study with more subjects to be able to make a determination about that. So essentially, the study was inconclusive because the finding was not statistically significant. You can't report that and say that that study showed that ivermectin is in effect. Again, it was a 69% lower odds of ivermectin-treated patients dying. So all I did was I wrote an article correcting the mainstream media's misinformation about that, and LinkedIn blocked me and incited that post of mine as justification for suspending my account. The third example they gave was an article I repeatedly tried to share on LinkedIn. LinkedIn blocked me every single time. Even in the comments sections, I couldn't provide a link to this article I wrote. It was an article about how the CDC's claim in August 2021 that vaccines induce immunity that's superior to natural immunity. Of course, at the time, the CDC had said that way back in August. I was pointing out that that was a lie. It was false. We already knew that that was false from, you know, a large body of scientific literature demonstrating the superiority of natural immunity. Then in January, just January this year, CDC researchers published a study in the CDC's journal, the MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, presenting data showing that natural immunity did offer better protection than being fully vaccinated. So I just reported how the CDC's claim that vaccines induce superior immunity was falsified by the CDC's own data. LinkedIn repeatedly blocked me and then cited those posts of mine as a justification for suspending my account. The interesting thing, I gained some insights in the appeals process, because of course they say you can appeal. Of course, it's not an appeal process. You really have no ability to even be confronted with what is the accusation. So in order to trigger the so-called appeal process, you have to express your agreement with their terms of use and their community guidelines. Now, their guidelines have this statement in there. It says, do not share content that directly contradicts guidance from leading global health organizations and public health authorities. That's in their section prohibiting misinformation. So I just asked them, I had a problem with agreeing to that term because I don't agree that I can't share content that contradicts quote unquote public health authorities. So I just asked Lincoln, I said, well, do your terms prohibit me from sharing factually accurate information that corrects misinformation from public health authorities such as the CDC? And their response was really instructive. Their response was that we do not offer interpretations of our community guidelines. So I stated
What does that mean? What does that mean? I mean, given that obviously there are different ways we could take what they're saying, they just refuse to clarify just belligerently?
They refused to specify. They refused to clarify that they had actually suspended my account because I was spreading misinformation. They refused to deny that they suspended my account because I was sharing truths that went against, you know, public health policies. So I just stated my acceptance of their guidelines with the understanding that I'm not prohibited from sharing factually accurate information, correcting official disinformation. That triggered the appeals process. And throughout the appeal, you know, throughout that process, I repeatedly asked, well, please specify what information you are accusing me of sharing that you are claiming to be false or misleading. LinkedIn perpetually refused to specify even a single claim I made or statement that I made in any of my posts or any of the articles I shared the links to. They refused to specify even a single example, refused to substantiate that accusation against me. So it was an interesting process. And of course, two examples there, the ivermectin blocking me from correcting the mainstream media misinformation about that, not being able to report the CDC's false claims falsified by its own data. Those are just two examples of how the fact checkers are censoring truth while helping to propagate official disinformation. And, you know, there's a long list of examples we could go through of truths that have been censored going back to the beginnings of the pandemic. Is if you talked about a lab origin of SARS-CoV-2, you know, that was censored as a quote unquote conspiracy theory. You couldn't talk about it. There's a long list of examples like that where truths were just absolutely censored and blocked. And now at this stage, a lot of these claims, they've walked back and they're now acknowledging that, you know, things that we were saying back then that were true, they're now acknowledging that, yeah, we were right, that that was true. I can name many examples. You know, you're very familiar, I'm sure, with, you know, a lot of them, with, you couldn't speak out against lockdowns. If you said, for example, that the authoritarian lockdown measures are unsupported by scientific evidence, which was true, they would try to block you from saying things like that, saying that there are harms of lockdowns to be considered, saying there's no scientific evidence to support mandatory use of cloth masks. Because, of course, you remember in the beginning, they were saying, don't use medical N95 masks because we need to reserve those for healthcare workers. So if you pointed out there was no scientific evidence to support mandatory use of cloth masks in the community setting as a means for reducing transmission of SARS-CoV-2, you know, you were blocked from saying that.
Well, let me jump in on that. I wrote a little something about this because Tim Pool, maybe you saw this, shared a before and after screenshot of YouTube's community guidelines. And I was a little surprised that YouTube was this specific. Normally, it seems like these platforms like to be deliberately vague. So you never really know if you're going over the line. You never really know where you stand until after the hammer has come down. Well, they, before whenever this change occurred, they had on there that if you question the value of masks to prevent the spread of the virus, that's a big problem and they're going to come after you, which they did with me. I did an episode, numerous episodes on this. I have one called The Definitive Masks Don't Work episode. They took that down. That's still up. If you get the podcast through any podcast app, you can still see that episode, or you go to tomwoods.com, you can still see that episode, but YouTube took it down. I did an interview with a sitting U.S. congressman, Thomas Massie, where he questioned it, and they took down the words of a sitting U.S. congressman. They had no problem with that. But now, they've dropped that. Now, I don't particularly want to test that thesis, Jeremy. I don't know if that's really true, that they've gotten rid of that and that you can say what you want on masks and your thing won't get taken down. Mm-hmm. But that was quietly removed. The other thing about lockdowns, the talk that kind of put me on the map in this COVID thing really was this one I gave at the end of 2020 at a Ron Paul event called The COVID Cult. And it was just a 20-minute talk, which I think helped to make it so popular. It wasn't 3 hours. 20 minutes summarizing the craziness of it. And it got a huge number of views. Between Facebook and YouTube, it was over 1.5 million views when they took it down. And when they took it down, they treated me to the fact check. Mm-hmm. And one was that I had claimed lockdowns were ineffective or didn't do any good, or they caused more harm than good and all that. And I had also said that the public health authorities had not acknowledged the collateral damage of lockdowns. And the correction that I was given was, well, that's not true. In September, the WHO said, in September. These things have been going on since March, and they think it's a shot against me that, you know, in a footnote to something nobody read, the WHO 6 months later, oh, said, oh, by the way, you know, we might damage society by doing this. What?
Yeah. By which time, of course, the UN had already estimating that the effects of lockdown would result in, you know, 10,000 excess childhood deaths per month by that time, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right about the YouTube. April or May of this year, quietly removed a number of prohibitions in its community guidelines, including they had prohibited claims that wearing a mask is dangerous or causes negative physical health effects. But of course, again, the WHO had pointed out in one of its guidance documents that the, you know, mandatory use of masking in community setting was unsupported by scientific evidence. I mean, that was the WHO saying that guidance document from the WHO, you know, pointed out that there are harms as well as benefits to be considered. Not controversial at all, that yes, there are harms associated with masks, especially when you're talking about forcing children to wear masks in school. This was a completely experimental policy with our children. The need for children to be able to see people's faces and see their expressions for development, language development, social development. So, you know, but just to claim that there are harms to consider as well as potential benefits. If you made that simple, non-controversial statement, that was blocked by YouTube. Yeah. Claims about treatments, if you pointed out that there were studies supporting the use of hydroxychloroquine as an effective treatment, when used early and in combination with zinc, if you said there's evidence that ivermectin is an effective treatment, those claims were blocked. Going back very early, if you said that COVID-19 vaccines are FDA unapproved products, the first vaccine to actually receive FDA authorization was Pfizer's. That didn't happen until August 2021. So from December 2020 until August 2021, all the vaccines were authorized for emergency use. But that didn't stop the mainstream media, of course, from claiming that they were FDA approved, which is false. In fact, emergency use authorization, EUA, is a status specifically for FDA unapproved products that are considered investigational or experimental. April 2021, there was a Reuters fact check claiming that they're not experimental products. Their basis for that, the premise was that because they're FDA approved. Reuters later, a month later, corrected that claim and acknowledged that they weren't approved, that they were just authorized for emergency use. But then it maintained its conclusion that they're not experimental products, even though EUA is, again, specifically a status for investigational experimental products. April 2021, the same month, Facebook prohibited claims that COVID-19 vaccines have not been approved. And of course, they weren't approved. And again, to illustrate that they have no problem with misinformation as long as it aligns with the policy goal of achieving high vaccine uptake. You know, here in Michigan, the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services was lying to the public in advertisements and policy documents claiming that they were FDA approved. Healthcare providers here in the area were making the same false claim. July 16th, Jen Psaki, in a White House press briefing, this is really interesting. She was talking about how we need to stop misinformation and how the White House was working with social media companies like Facebook to stop misinformation from being spread. And she argued that anyone who spreads misinformation on one platform should be banned from all platforms. And as an example of this so-called misinformation, she cited people who, quote, falsely allege that mRNA vaccines are untested and thus risky, even though many of them are approved and have gone through the gold standard of the FDA approval process. At the time, if you went to the FDA's website and looked up the fact sheets for any of the COVID-19 vaccines, those fact sheets stated right in there that there were no FDA-approved vaccines for COVID-19 and that the vaccines authorized for emergency use had not undergone the same type of review as an FDA-approved product. Of course, we all remember the way the vaccines were sold to the public was that they would stop transmission, that they would two doses would induce durable sterilizing immunity, meaning that would prevent infection and transmission, thereby inducing herd immunity, and that would be the path out of the pandemic. That's how they were sold to the public. If you pointed out that the claim that the vaccines would induce durable sterilizing immunity was unsupported by scientific evidence, you were blocked, you were banned for saying that. Even though, of course, now everyone acknowledges that the vaccines don't prevent transmission. In fact, Google was, and YouTube, as you mentioned earlier, this is one of those things that they were prohibiting until very recently, like April or May. You couldn't say that COVID-19 vaccines are not effective in preventing the spread of COVID-19, or you'd be banned by YouTube. Again, Google didn't remove that until like April or May of this year, 7 or 8 months after CDC researchers had observed a large outbreak in Massachusetts, in which 74% of cases were fully vaccinated people. And CDC Director Rochelle Walensky admitted on CNN that the vaccines do not prevent transmission. Just as a note, she was claiming that she implied that that was a function of the Delta variant, which is partly true, but what she was concealing is that it was largely a function of the vaccine and simple waning immunity of the vaccine. Of course, natural immunity, we've seen how they've prevented people from telling the truth that natural immunity is superior. We've seen how the public health establishment, the CDC, have downplayed or altogether ignored natural immunity, including in their guidance, their policies. We saw the Biden administration attempt to coerce even naturally immune people into getting vaccinated. So, you know, I've kind of gone through an example of that with LinkedIn, where I was banned from pointing out that the CDC's claim was belied by its own data. Another claim that the mRNA and vaccine-induced spike protein, if you said that studies had shown that both persist in the body for months, actually Epoch Times had an article pointing that out. This was May. There was a health feedback fact check article, you know, that you saw on Facebook. And the counterclaim from health feedback was that the mRNA and the spike protein are eliminated from the body, quote, within days. That was false. Studies, in fact, have shown that both the mRNA and the spike persist for months. Health Feedback was essentially following the CDC's example in that, because the CDC was making the same false claim that the mRNA and spike are eliminated within days. And the CDC has since quietly removed that claim from its website. Another recent example, Dr. Deborah Birx coming out and saying on Fox News, I believe this was July, that she knew the vaccines would not prevent transmission. And then PolitiFact put out a fact check article claiming that it was false, that she had changed her tune, that she changed her position. PolitiFact argued that she had always been consistent, you know, in being honest with the public about the effectiveness of the vaccines. However, again, turning to PolitiFact's own sources, two of its own cited sources proved that Birx had in fact claimed that the vaccines would induce durable sterilizing immunity, that they would confer herd immunity. So,
and we all knew that.
Yeah,
I mean, for heaven's sake, right? We had all sat through that. We'd all heard all of them say it.
That was the basis for selling the vaccines to the public at the time.
Yeah.
As lockdown measures continued, they had the argument that Dr. Liana Wen, CNN, you know, medical analyst, talking about how when states started lifting lockdown measures, and she was criticizing this and saying, well, now is the time we have to continue these measures because if we don't, people aren't going to get vaccinated. And so we need to continue these measures to coerce people into getting vaccinated. The coercive nature of the policies, where it was designed to essentially coerce the population into accepting these products on the basis of misinformation, official disinformation about their safety, their effectiveness. And if you said anything that went against the public policy, you were censored. Another very recent example, there was a study out of Thailand looking at adverse cardiovascular effects in adolescents following administration of the second dose of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. The study reported finding about 1 in 3 participants experienced heart effects, and 1 in 43 were diagnosed with heart inflammation. This was reported on Twitter by Dr. Simone Gold, who was the founder of the organization Frontline Physicians, something with Frontline Physicians.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and I can't think of the exact wording either.
Yeah, and so Reuters did a fact check of her tweet claiming that she was spreading misinformation. Reuters claimed that only 1 in 6 experienced heart effects detected by electrocardiogram or ECG, which was true. Abnormal ECG was only one of 11 criteria used by the study authors, and only one of those criteria were required for the definition of cardiac manifestation to have been met. So Reuters withheld that from readers and withheld the fact that it stated right in the abstract that yes, 29% experienced adverse cardiovascular effects. The other argument that Reuters made was that only one participant out of the 301 had confirmed myocarditis, not 1 in 43, like claimed by Simone Gold. But Gold hadn't claimed that 7 participants, that 1 in 43 equates to 7. There were 7 in total. She didn't claim that 7 were diagnosed with myocarditis. She said 1 in 43 had heart inflammation, which is correct, because there were also, in addition to the 1 confirmed case of myopericarditis, there were 4 cases of subclinical myocarditis and 2 cases of diagnosed pericarditis. So she was correct. That's 1 in 43. So here we have, again, an example of a fact check claiming that true information, factually accurate information, is false while itself propagating misinformation. And examples like this just go on and on.
By the way, we were trying to think of America's frontline doctors.
Yes,
that
was
the name of the
thing. Yes.
That we were trying to think of. Hey, everybody, a quick word from our sponsor, Crowd Health. What if you didn't have to pay healthcare premiums anymore? What if you could invest that money, for example, in Bitcoin instead? If health insurance companies invest your premiums, they reap the rewards, not you. But with Crowd Health, you can put aside money for health expenses in your own account and even hold part of it in Bitcoin if you like. And if Bitcoin goes up, you get the upside, not the big insurance companies. Now, the reason your healthcare bills are so high in the first place is because of our screwed up, crazy system. The buyers of healthcare, health plans, and the sellers of healthcare, hospital systems, want costs to rise. You think, how can that possibly be? Well, Obamacare limits how much profit they can make. So on $1,000 of monthly premiums, they can make $150. Well, they're profit maximizing entities. They can only increase their profit by raising your price. So if your premium goes up 10%, their profits can go up 10%. So no wonder healthcare prices are going up. Health plans are not negotiating for you. So here's how Crowd Health works. You pay one low monthly total, usually less than $200, to fund an account that is yours. You can hold 75% of that in Bitcoin if you want. You can choose whatever doctor you want. And if you have a big bill, Crowd Health will crowdfund that bill for you so you can pay the doctor or hospital quickly. You have a personal care advocate who takes care of your questions so you can kiss big call centers goodbye. Just schedule a call with your care advocate and you can talk to the same person every time. So stop supporting the broken health insurance system with your hard-earned dollars. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods now and experience freedom from health insurance. by utilizing Bitcoin. Right now, you can get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's almost 50% off the normal price and a lot less than a high deductible healthcare plan. Just go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods to sign up. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. By the way, this is not directly related, but you know there's a professor at Stanford, John Ioannidis, who's been pretty good on some aspects of this issue, like right from the beginning.
Yes.
He was questioning whether it was really as lethal as we'd been told. And the thing is, he had such a stellar scholarly reputation that it was hard even for the crazy people just to dismiss him. They always had to say, well, look, we all know John's a genius and everything, but I think he's wrong on this. Like, they didn't do to him what they did to the rest of us, which is, you're a stupid crank and I don't need to acknowledge you. They had to acknowledge him. Well, anyway, just the other day, something called Retraction Watch tweeted that a paper of his earned a correction. Well, in response to this claim by Retraction Watch, which is obviously meant to make him look bad, the former dean of Harvard Medical School, who obviously is a fairly establishment guy, said, look, the correction you're talking about was an added parenthesis in a formula. He says, this tweet with a photo with no further explanation is really deceptive, obviously unfair to Professor Ioannidis, and in my opinion, the author deserves an apology from Retraction Watch. So, I mean, I know this is not directly related to COVID, but I don't know, would you pick out a paper from 2005 from just a random professor that had one parenthesis missing that was then changed and then call that out in 2022 as a paper requiring correction? You know, and this was even too much for the dean of Harvard Medical School, like the, you know, which is the center of mainstream medicine. Like, even they had to say this is unfair.
Yeah, Ioannidis actually is the author of one of, if not the most highly cited paper in all of the medical literature. He's very widely acknowledged as, you know, just a leading researcher. And one of his specialties, like one of the areas of research that he specializes in, is in identifying, and that paper was actually on this topic, you know, of just how bad a lot of science and a lot of scientific studies are.
Let me tell people, the name of the article is Why Most Published Research Findings Are False.
Yes.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that paper is actually, if not the, it's one of the most highly cited papers in all of the literature. But of course, you never see the fact checkers correcting official misinformation, right? So for example, on Twitter, sometime back, promoting, you know, you just go to your feed and at the top of your feed or in the sidebar, there would be this just alert that the CDC and fact checkers say that vaccines confer superior immunity, better than natural immunity. And so to support that, Twitter cited an AP fact check article. That AP fact check article cited a single CDC press release in which the CDC did make that claim. Evidently, nobody at AP could be bothered to actually read the study that the CDC was reporting in that press release, because in fact, that study didn't include anyone with natural immunity. Anyone with natural immunity was excluded from that study. The study only included participants or subjects whose immune systems had been primed by vaccination. So you tell me, Tom, how can a study that excluded anyone with natural immunity prove that the vaccines confer superior immunity? I don't see how that's possible. And yet, evidently, AP couldn't be bothered to even read the study before reporting on critically parroting the CDC's demonstrably false claim. And then, of course, you know, Twitter using that to suppress the truth about how the vaccines actually induced inferior immunity. In fact, it's now been demonstrated. This is a really important thing that I want to emphasize to your listeners, is studies have actually confirmed a phenomenon known as original antigenic sin is a problem with these vaccines. And so what happens is that the initial priming of the immune system, whether by infection or vaccination, can, depending on the pathogen, can detrimentally affect future immune responses to variants. So what happens with natural immunity to SARS-CoV-2, it does induce broad, durable immunity, although, of course, with variants, it can escape the antibody response. So the sterilizing immunity that might come from antibodies that prevent the virus from being able to infect cells in the first place, that can fail, even the antibody defense can fail. However, there's cellular immune responses that continue to be effective. And of course, reduce symptoms. But the immune response from infection is adaptive. So if you do become reinfected with a variant, the immune system learns to adapt the antibody response and other immune responses, T cell responses, to be more specific to that infecting variant. this doesn't occur with vaccination. What appears to happen with vaccination is the imprinting of the immune response to respond to the spike protein of the original Wuhan strain impairs, relative to the natural immune response, impairs the immune system's ability to adapt. So when people who have been vaccinated experience infection with a variant, their immune systems fail to adapt to that variant, and they end up remaining focused on producing responses to the spike protein, the now extinct Wuhan strain, which is extinct outside of laboratories. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that we have to consider natural immunity to be an opportunity cost of vaccination. And this is, of course, something that policymakers perpetually fail to consider with COVID-19 vaccines or any vaccine, because, of course, there are benefits to infection as well as risks to infection, just as there are benefits and risks of vaccines. To fail to consider natural immunity as an opportunity cost is a major failing of the public health establishment.
Well, this is all very discouraging, but at the same time, it amazes me that when I look sometimes at the comments section of certain posts or articles or this and that, how many people aren't buying the establishment line on so much, even though it is fed to them from all the official outlets, and the unofficial outlets find themselves being suppressed, or there's a chilling effect that makes them not publish in the first place. Yet somehow there is still a huge number of people who just don't buy the propaganda, whether it's this or whether it's critical race theory stuff or whatever. People just don't buy it. So imagine how well we'd be doing if we had a level playing field. We are, of course, seeing the rise of alternative platforms slowly, more slowly than we'd like. But a lot of people are getting a lot of traction on Rumble now.
Yep.
That's almost the first place people go. I'd like to see Odyssey pick up some slack too. I think some of my previous episodes would have been, you and I would have talked about this and we would have said, well, this sucks. All right, thanks, Jeremy. Goodbye. What's your website? And that's it. But I do want to kind of, you know, be a little bit of a light in the darkness here and,
yes,
and let people know that the way we're describing it is not the whole story, that actually it is quite surprising. In a world of ABC, CBS, and NBC, I think almost nobody would have looked at alternative voices, you know? So there is something to be said.
No, I definitely want to end on an optimistic point of view, because I do have a lot of optimism. I think, you know, one of the benefits, one of the good things that has arisen out of all this is there has been this mass awakening as to the untrustworthiness of public health officials, and in fact, the entire public health establishment, by which I'm using that synonymously with the medical establishment, because it is the public health establishment. Huge awakening and realization, mass realization of the untrustworthiness of the CDC, the FDA. And so this is a good thing. And of course, you know, whenever the media talk about what they call vaccine hesitancy, and there's a body of literature on what they call vaccine hesitancy, the underlying assumption of that entire body of literature is that there are no legitimate reasons for parents to choose not to get any of the CDC recommended vaccines for their children, which of course is ridiculous. So there's plenty of legitimate reasons why parents might choose to not follow the CDC schedule. The censorship predates the COVID-19 pandemic. And so before the pandemic, if you talked, you know, said anything that they considered to be anti-vaccine, meaning anything, no matter how factually accurate, that didn't align with the public policy goals, you were censored for that. And I wrote an ebook for Children's Health Defense describing this problem. And as a result of the pandemic and the government's responses with the lockdowns, where of course we've seen that the claimed benefits of the lockdowns, the mandatory masking, never manifested in the data, whereas the harms have been absolutely devastating, uncontroversially so, there really has been an awakening. There is a lot of reason for optimism. People are finding alternative platforms, alternative methods and means of getting factually accurate information out to the masses. So there is a lot of reason for optimism. I absolutely want to emphasize that the side of truth is winning. It's an uphill battle, but we're getting there.
What's your website? Is that the best way for people to follow you?
Yeah, absolutely. Head to jeremyrhammond.com. I use my middle initial there for my writing name, jeremyrhammond.com. And just sign up for my newsletter. It'd be the best way to stay up to date with my work and stay in touch. And of course, all my links to all my social media profiles are included in any of my newsletters. Head to jeremyrhammond.com and subscribe to my newsletter.
Okay, so that's Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N-D. So jeremyrhammond.com. I'll have it linked at tomwoods.com/2198. Well, thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate your travails and learning about them, and glad that our side of things continues to forge ahead.
Always an honor to talk to you, Tom. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, our old friend Dan McCarthy joins us again. We're going to talk about Trump and DeSantis and 2024. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.